What I have to say about the Brooks Range tonight is a little bit hard to say. I suppose most people, when they think of the Arctic, when they think of Alaska, especially people outside, they think of something that's very cold and icy and not very interesting, except for some catastrophe, something dramatic. Some life and death matter that you read about in all the magazines. But you who are working here to promote proper sportsmanship, the proper enjoyment of the outdoors in the highest tradition, I think will understand the experience that we had this summer. First of all, I want to say that the financial sponsor of our expedition was the Conservation Foundation of New York. Their personnel has been up in Alaska. They're very much interested in the true advancement of Alaska, as I think you would all agree with their ideas. And also, I am president of the Wilderness Society. I have that honor. I'm working with the Wilderness Society, and that's my full-time job. And we're trying to promote these areas where people can go with pack horses, with packs on their backs, any way to get away into the outdoors as God made it. And I think people throughout the United States, throughout North America, throughout the world, are beginning now to realize that that kind of serenity, that kind of enjoyment of the outdoors is a needed element of the civilization we're trying to build. There were five of us on the party this summer. Dr. Bryna Kessel of the University of Alaska was with us under the direction of Dr. Buckley, collecting specimens and making observations of the animal life there. And she started a program that I think will mean a great deal in the future for the students of that university, of our school right here, the Farthest North University. And it seems very appropriate to me that they should begin to study the ecology of that northern country. She marked out some plots for year-by-year study. She's a good field woman, too. And she went off by herself overnight with a pack on her back and made studies of some of these areas and marked out places for future work. There was also with us Robert Creer of Wyoming and Colorado, a young man who is working on his PhD, and also George Schaller, who graduated from this university and is now at Wisconsin in his postgraduate work. Those two fellows are real mountaineers. And it was a pleasure to see how they could travel over those mountains. George Schaller, well, each member, I should say, of our party at one time or another went overnight and camped out by themselves. And George Schaller took 7 days a week in the high mountains, got over on the other side of the divide, went over the Hula Hula River, and down the East Fork of the Chandelier and back to camp. He covered a tremendous amount of territory in that week's time with a pack on his back. And one of the most wonderful memories that I think Mrs. Murray and I will have will be those 5 days when we left our base camp with packs on our backs. I always figured I'd take her along to carry the pack, but I had a pack too. And we both went up for those 5 days up to the head of the Steenjack River and camped forever. Night came, if you could call it night. We had daylight nearly all night. And we made a camp just anywhere in the lee of some willows, just put down our sleeping bags, and stopped there for the night, and next day went on. It's an experience that we'll never forget. I can't explain why exactly, but I think you'll understand. We were way back in the Arctic wilderness. There was serenity there. There were birds and plants and moss and lichens and mountains all around us, and that twisting, winding river, the overflow ice and all the rest of, that goes with that type of country. And we enjoyed every bit of it. I will speak a little more about that when we show our slides a little later. But in the early part of the trip, we had as a guest of our party, Dr. McLeod of Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where we live. He's a very fine physician. He's so busy that I don't know how many hours a day he works. He just run to death by all people who have all kinds of troubles and come to see him. And he decided this summer to take 2 weeks off, and he spent those with us up there. I never saw anyone so excited about the little things of the wilderness, the little beauties, the little, I don't know what you would call it, the little experiences with the ptarmigan and the other wildlife of that area. And he had his camera along. Now, he's a wonderful skier. He's one of the fine skiers of the Jackson Hole country, an outdoor man who goes into the country with pack horses and has traveled considerably. When he left, he said, "This is the best trip of my life." And the last week we were up there, as probably you know, Bill Douglas, Justice Douglas, and his wife came up there and spent a week with us. It rained a good deal of that time. We had the worst weather trip while they were there. But he was a good sport. He's had a little trouble with his hip, as you know, and he wanted to climb all the mountains. We had an awful time keeping him down a little. His wife cooperated, and I tried to convince him that he shouldn't try to climb that mountain until he got in better shape. But they too had a wonderful trip. And as I've said elsewhere, when we were rainbound in the tent and sitting around the fire, he would tell us about his excursions throughout the world, in the back country of the world, in just that kind of wilderness. And they left, the two of them left, feeling very excited about their experience. Only a week back here in what people generally in the States think of as a wasteland. There's a treasure there. I think I have with me an excerpt from a letter that Mrs. Douglas wrote us. We received it yesterday. And this is one of her statements in the letter. "Oh, how can I ever start to tell you what our week in the Steenjack meant to us? To me, it was more than a real experience. I shall never forget it, and shall probably keep a longing always with me to go back." Well, we were there from June 1st I don't know when we came back, about a week ago, I guess, or so. I lost track of time. We were there a good deal of the summer. And that area, of course, has a short season. I noticed that the flowers, the vegetation, was much further advanced than it is here now. Things in bloom here that were through blooming up there. And being that far north and close to the top of the range and so on, naturally everything is shorter. I mean, the season is short. But we had the midnight sun, and there was, I don't know, we fell in love with the moss and lichens on the rock and the slide rock and the, I hate to even use those terms, they seem to belittle what we found in that environment, that far north environment, where for the time being we could feel this is ours, this is for the public, this is for people. And next year someone else can go there and they can have the same feeling. It's theirs. It belongs to them. There's no private keep out signs. There's no there's no watch out, be careful signs and all that sort of thing that you find in so many places down in our country. And it's open for anybody and everybody who really want that experience. I want to say a word there's about wilderness areas. There's been a lot of confusion in the minds of people about that. The wilderness program, which is now being supported by sportsmen clubs throughout the United States, by the Federation of Wildlife Federation, the Wildlife Management Institute, the Sierra Club, the Federation of Western Outdoor Clubs, and the Audubon Society and Wilderness Society, where they're all getting together these days. We find out that we have something in common, something we're trying to foster in the lives of people, and that is quality. Quality rather than numbers. Quality for the individual. We like to foster the idea that the individual is more important than the mass, the individual person. And his experience should be paramount in his life, not be just a part of a mass movement. And so the wilderness movement is predicated on the idea that we should have a few areas here and there in their original condition for those people who like to go into it. Now, the wilderness areas we have throughout the United States, throughout our country and in some foreign countries, are areas where hunting is permitted, of course. Hunting, trapping, fishing, photographing, camping, where they have horses, they travel with horses, backpacking, anything you want to, except that we try to keep out the more permanent urban structures. No hot dog stands and no roads and that sort of thing. You're on your own in the wilderness. That is what we're trying to promote. And really, it's just a designation of a piece of land or an area that is given over to that purpose. It is not kept from the people. People can go in there, anyone that wants to. But the idea is that we should have a few areas where we don't have mass hunting. I can refer you to things that happened in Wyoming and Montana and so on, where people now go in with jeeps and cars. One man asked a game warden in Wyoming, "Where can I get an elk on the oil?" He didn't want to leave his car. And they go out after antelope, and they're very proud if they get their antelope in the morning before breakfast, and they can get back home with the meat and so on. Well, that's all right. There are places where they can do that, but let's have a few places where we have quality. A few places here and there throughout our whole continent where people in increasing numbers, mind you, are wanting that serenity, that communion with the universe that means so much to so many people. That is what we mean by wilderness area. We have them on the national forests and the Indian reservations and various others. There's even one or two state wilderness areas in California. And let me say that some of the wilderness areas in California, where the population has become very dense, are so used, so heavily used now, by proper recreation, proper use of people, that the recreation stock, the pack horses, are beginning to overgraze the meadows. The Sierra Club and other groups out there now are trying to contrive some kind of a program whereby they can have a little more backpacking and just take pack horses and don't ride and so on, trying to reduce the number of horses in that area. Of course, you don't have that problem here. But I just want to point out what is coming in the future. When people begin, as they do, and they have a right to want these areas, they become more numerous, and there's heavier use of these areas. And to my notion, it seems to me that is a proper objective of our culture. In 1948 and 49, my wife and I and our youngest son had the privilege of going to New Zealand to study an elk problem they have there in the southern part of New Zealand in a real wilderness area. Oh, it was very rough. Yeah, I think if they had sought the world over, they couldn't have found a worse place to release elk. And the country was all up on edge, and there's 250 inches of rainfall average a year, and the elk are falling off cliffs. One of the mortality factors of that elk herd was falling off cliffs. And anyhow, we were struck with one thing. In New Zealand, I don't think we saw any millionaires. Neither were there any slums. People were happy. People went hunting. They never thought of taking a jeep or a car. They just walked off into that wilderness with a pack on their back. Our expedition, of course, they were very courteous to me. They made me head of the expedition and so on. But they had 30 or 40 people on the trip at times. And it was a deluxe thing. They wouldn't let me do anything. I thought I could hike, but I couldn't keep up with those fellas. And they had huge packs. They put advanced camps away from the base camp, way back in the mountains, and all I had to do was walk in there, and there was a cook and all the rest of it. I never had such an experience in all my life. Well, those people were, as they would say, fit. They knew how to hike. I went up Mount Egmont one Sunday with my family, and on that Sunday, there were 150 people climbing that mountain. People from the nearby towns that came out, they have a government hostel, as they call it, at the foot of the mountain. It's a national park. And they were all out just climbing the mountain. And another time later in the season, we went to what they call the Southern Alps. Our trip was over, and I wanted to dry out a little bit. We'd had such a soaking rain and all that down there. And we went in there to the government hostel, and we climbed up Mount Sebastopol, as they call it. And I was interested in seeing where the introduced European hare was eating all the vegetation up, and they had an awful time there. But while we were up there, here came a whole troop of young people. And we met them and talked with them. And we found that they were high school students, several classes with their instructors. They'd come out to this hostel and were spending the day in the mountains. Those people were wonderful hunters. They were good shots. And they combined that with a love of beauty. All the homes had flower gardens around them. They just loved flower gardens. And they had places where you would pay something. I never got used to the money system down there, but you'd pay to go in and go through a kind of conservatory or something where they had the wildflowers. And near the capital city of Wellington, they had what they call the bush, native forest. You could take the tram or car out to the edge of the town, and there was a jungle right in front of you with trails through it, and people out there walking the trails and enjoying the jungle. That's right near the capital city of Wellington. I was impressed as I listened to your program here tonight with your interest in the Girl and Boy Scouts. It seems to me that's a wonderful thing for a sportsman organization to do. When I left Wyoming, I'd written to Ted Pettit of the Boy Scout organization in New York, and I proposed to him that the Wilderness Society would probably sponsor some wilderness trips for their Explorer Scouts. Not that we have the money to put into it, but we would try to get the guides or something, and possibly only one or two, maybe three scouts on any one trip. Not a great big hilarious troop just to go in for a picnic or anything like that, but the real Explorer Scouts, and they would select them by some kind of a contest. I don't know how. He was very much excited about it, and I'm going to get in touch with him when I get back. And I can think of no better experience for a young person, Explorer Scout, whether he's interested in hunting or photographing or whatever he's interested in, than that kind of a trip we had this summer in the Shinjak country of the Brooks Range. And I want to follow up on this and see if we can get the young people to going out and experiencing that quality in the outdoors that we're all striving for. I want to say, I'm wondering a little off the subject, but I do want to say that I think there's a very hopeful sign. Last fall, I was invited to go to Bonneville County Sportsman's Jamboree, as they call it. They have it annually in Idaho. Went to Idaho Falls, and they asked me to give a talk in the afternoon. Well, I'd never attended one of their groups. I didn't know what kind of program they had, but I found that they were all taken up, they were all interested in trying to preserve some of their wilderness areas, trying to prevent encroachments on them. And I was amazed. I don't know what I expected, but I was surprised to see the feeling there for their wilderness area. And I spoke on that question there, and that the secretary of the Sportsman's Association came around to me and asked if I would appear on TV that night. Well, I'd never been on TV. I didn't know anything about it, but I said, all right. And that night, I was to have a discussion with the leader for 10 minutes. And he asked me, he said, I don't know anything about this wilderness movement. What questions should I ask you? And I don't want to embarrass you. And I told him, I said, let's be honest and straightforward in this thing. You can't embarrass me. Ask any questions you want, and I'll answer them honestly. And that's all there was to it. And then the secretary of the sportsman group came around and he said, say the same thing he said as you did this afternoon at the meeting. Now that's a feeling that's growing in Idaho. And in Montana, we had a meeting of the Wilderness Society, I think it was 3 years ago. And at our meeting, we had visitors to our meeting, representatives of various organizations, including the Commercial Club people of Montana, and they were all for that our program. And the man representing the Montana State Grange, he's also a senator of Montana. He was there also, and he's devoting the rest of his life to this purpose. And I was surprised and pleased by the action. And the state game warden later came, I saw him at the wildlife conference, I think it was in Washington, or Chicago it was, and he had two proposals. He wanted to help to get the wilderness, two additional wilderness areas in Montana. And a Montana member of the Game Commission there said that the only hope that they have in Montana to save the grizzly bear, which is going out of the states pretty much everywhere, is in the wilderness areas. There's the only hope for the grizzly bear, what few they have left. So I just want to say that what you're striving for here in Alaska is in line with what we're other places, what we're trying to do in other parts of our continent. And it pleases me to be up here this summer. I talked with people at Fort Yukon. I talked with a great many people here in Fairbanks. And I've talked with people at Palmer and Anchorage, the places where I've been. And I find more and more people who are thinking about the proper future of our country, of our Alaska. As I've been up here before, and I fell in love with the country in 1920 when I first came here. I traveled with dog teams up in the Brooks Range and so on. This summer is the first time I've been there in summertime. I've always been there in the winter up to the Cresses Range and so on with dog teams and when everything is snow-covered. And I loved it then. I did. It was wonderful. It isn't the fierce, terrible thing that you read about in the papers. If you take the proper precautions and travel as you should, and so on. I don't like to dramatize things as if they're terrible, just to satisfy my ego in articles in the magazines that you see everywhere. I know things happen, very serious things. But the main thing that I have found in Alaska, the thing that impresses me is the beauty of this Arctic, the quality of the wilderness area of the North Country. And I just can't say enough about that, because I really think it's going to mean a great deal to people in the future. I don't know just what to say about our in detail about our trip in the Brooks Range this summer, except that I don't know whether I mentioned Brandon Kessel listed 86 birds up there north of the Arctic Circle. 86 different kinds of birds. We saw the migration of the waterfowl in the lake there at our first base camp. The caribou came around us, and we saw them almost daily for a while, and then they wandered somewhere else. I don't know where they went. And then we saw a tremendous herd traveling by our camp in July. I estimated 1,500 in that band that went by our camp that night. And we all rushed out to the side of the mountain for a good view, and Bob Currier had his movie camera, and we sat there with our fully field glasses and watched them way into the night, if you can call it night. going by, grunting and feeding as they went, running here and there just as caribou will. It was a wonderful sight, and none of us will ever forget it. And next day, Bob Currier was out again, and he saw another herd of, I think there were quite a few hundred, and the next day some more. And I think if people could observe that under those conditions, way off in that solitude, not from the car window, not from the train window, but from your own 2 feet, it makes a big difference. And so I would like to make a plea that we seriously consider to designate a few areas for that kind of use, for public use, for the good of humanity, for the good of those people who crave that sort of thing. You know, democracy, which we claim we have and which are striving to build, it seems to me is based on the same principle as evolution, and that is diversity. The dictator likes to have conformity. Everybody do the same. Everybody think the same. Everybody enjoy things in the same way. But democracy and evolution depends on exploring. And lots of people would like to go where they can go with car, well and good. Lots of them can't do otherwise. And let's have that too. Let's have places where people can enjoy different kinds of things. Let's try to also provide for those who have the ambition and the desire to go into our back country and enjoy nature as it was made originally. I would like to see a few places, a few pieces of Alaska remain Alaska, and not a replica of New York or Chicago and so on. And I don't want to talk too much about this phase of it now. I just, I will later show some slides from our experience up there, and maybe you will have some questions too about it later. But I do want to say that I don't know when. I've been to Alaska a great many times in the past years, but I don't know when I've been more encouraged by the sentiment I have found here among present-day Alaskans. As I said, I had to visit with quite a few people in Fort Yukon, and they seem to be thoroughly in accord with trying to have a few places like this. Noel Ween of the Ween Airlines came up there with a passenger to see me once, and he was very much pleased with the idea himself. And what we have in mind is this. Now, it would have taken